Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
He was last seen by us December 21st of 2002. We last heard from him by phone in 2003. And I'm assuming that my thoughts at that time were that he was in Peoria at that time. Clint and the woman he was with, it was just, they left Kewaunee and moved to a rural town. And then from there, we got that call and then he was gone. And no one heard from him since, not Social Security, not the IRS. Nobody has heard from him since.
And then they got that weird anonymous letter that was typed with no return address in September of 2003. In the letter, he said he met a rich woman that was going to take care of him. He was going to change his identity and disappear. And basically, I hate my whole family. You guys are all terrible. I never want to see you again. Don't try to contact me. And I'm going to go live in Texas under a new name with this random rich woman. You know, hearing that, I'm like, there's no way Clint wrote that.
In early 2003, 29-year-old Clinton Washburn called his parents and he was angry. The whole thing ended up being a misunderstanding that they worked out during that phone call. But after that, they stopped hearing from Clint. Months later, in September of 2003, they received a typed letter allegedly from Clint. It stated that he found a rich woman to marry. He was going to take her name and they would never find him. Clint's parents were crushed by this letter. And they didn't know of any way they could reach their son. The letter had no return address. Believing their son wanted no contact and hoping that maybe someday he would change his mind, Clint's parents did all they could do. They waited. They thought that perhaps he would call or show up at the door, but it never happened. Clint's father passed away in 2018, and his mother Margie thought for sure he would turn up at that time, but still no word from Clint. It was after that Margie decided to report her son missing, more than 15 years after that letter arrived in the mail. What they came to learn was that there was no trace of Clint since 2003. And the more they found out, the more disturbing things became. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 376 of The Vanished, Clinton Washburn's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices and audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Clint Washburn's story is different from most other stories we have told on The Vanished. His family believed for many years that he had left voluntarily and wanted to be estranged from their lives. Is it possible that Clint is out there somewhere alive, living under a new identity? Or was that letter a cover story for something more sinister? And whoever wrote it just wanted his family to think that, so that they wouldn't keep looking for him. If that was the plan, it worked, at least for a very long time. We're going to begin by taking a look at Clint's life. Was he someone who would have chosen to walk away from his life and never look back? We spoke to Clint's mom, Margie, who was the driving force behind the search efforts today, and she told us about Clint's early years.
In Clint's early life, well, I almost died giving birth. And he, despite a dream I had that my first was going to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed, he was brown-haired and brown-eyed. one of the things that stand out to me is he was upset with my husband and myself. He was about 2 or 3 years old. He put on his little puffy jacket and his stocking hat and mittens and boots, and he went outside, went all the way down to the line between our yard and grandma's and grandpa's. And he came back in after a little while, and he looked up at me, and he said, "God wants to talk to you." And it just really stunned me. We both just looked at each other, and we took him to church, him and his little brother, to church. And he loved Sunday school.
Clint was born in Illinois and lived there for many years with his parents and younger brother. But they later relocated to Arizona for a period of years. This move seemed to completely disrupt Clint's life.
You know, you don't like to think that you, I don't call it broke a child, but you did something that you shouldn't have done, as far as we moved from our hometown when Clint was 9 years old. And we moved to Arizona. From then on, he kind of didn't do so well. He was able to skip school. I wouldn't be notified for 2 weeks after. We went from a town of about 12,000 people to, what, 500,000? And he was able to get lost. We ran away after we first got there. And the police came, and apparently in that town, they can arrest a child. And they told us that, and we were just stunned. We thought they would just go out and find him. So the thing was, he and his brother just acclimated into the culture there so seamlessly. It was just a beautiful thing. But after 5 years, we moved back to Illinois, and he was angry about that. He was a teenager then, and he rebelled. He skipped school and hung out with an older lady and just refused to stop seeing her, and he was extremely upset that in a small town, everybody knows everybody else's business. We probably shouldn't have left Illinois and disrupted his life. As far as whether he went back to school, he stayed in school. I think one of the things that kind of hurt his psyche a bit was that his brother got to skip a grade, and then they wanted him to skip another grade. So I'm sure Clint didn't feel like as smart as his brother, but he was wrong. I thought you were either creative or, I know this is the wrong way to say it, creative or intelligent, and he was both, and so is his brother. So he could take a computer apart and put it back together again, and he knew his way around the software, and he also could draw, and he had cursive that was so beautiful that he would forge notes from me to the school, and they would never know the difference to get out of school. So he was able to do that. He did want to start a comic strip.
Margie regrets ever moving to Arizona, but things seemed better once they returned to Illinois. It was after high school that Clint decided to enlist in the Army.
As far as Clint wanting to go into the military, I think it's because when he was in high school, we were always getting calls that he was getting in trouble. Just your typical high school stuff. I don't know if it was causing a scene in the classroom or whatever, but I think someone put the bug in his ear about doing that. And his dad was Air Force and his grandpa was Navy. So he picked the Army. I think it's the best thing that ever happened to him. I think he made some really close bonds there. He sent home wonderful letters and gifts.
While Clint was in the Army, he became best friends with his roommate, Jay. We had the opportunity to speak with Jay to learn more about this time in Clint's life.
When I was stationed at Fort Polk, my first duty station, Fort Polk, Leesville, Louisiana, he was my roommate, Army buddy. I was assigned to his room. So we had the same MOS, the same job. So that's where I met him there, being assigned to the same unit, and then being assigned to his room. So he was like a big brother, you would say. We played cards all night long. It was like just when you just know you get along with somebody. I mean, first, you know, I looked up to him as a big brother because he was there before me. I want to say he had almost a year of service before me. So he was there to show me the ropes and kind of guide me. So when I was assigned to his barracks room, it was just the two of us. We just, I mean, instantly clicked, and he was just down to earth. Very easy, very outgoing. We just bonded. They come from a small town and couldn't probably live that small town life. And I think that, you know, the military definitely opened up some doors for him. A lot of times we did stay at the barracks and we just drink and play cards. And I was the athletic out of our group because I had college aspiration of playing football. So we spent a lot of time out in the gym and running. I mean, he was always there with me. We went everywhere together. He was a good soldier. As far as military, when we were together, he was very good.
Clint and Jay took different paths after their time in the military. Jay went on to college and was enjoying that lifestyle, while Clint wanted to settle down.
I got out, I want to say, 6 months before him, maybe 4 months before him, before he came to college and met me in college, and we lived together for one semester. After the first semester of college, he left because he was married in the military. So it's like the last 6 months while I was there, I was still in. He got married after college, after he left that semester. That's why I feel bad for not being a good friend. We just never talked. We lost touch. And a lot of it's my fault. A lot of it, because when I went to college, I went wild. I was just got a fraternity, just meeting girls. I was the outgoing person, and he was more the reserved person. And for him to be missing, I kind of feel guilty that had I been a good friend and stayed in touch regularly, maybe I could have been someone to just listen. If he had troubles, I could have been someone to talk to. I mean, I don't know who he had after me. Like, he got married. I mean, the few girls that, really just two girls that he dated, I mean, you know, he fell in love with them instantly, but he never mistreated. I never see him mistreat any girls. He would get a broken heart very easily. He would fall in love easily. He wanted to be married in the military. I mean, when she got married, I was like, are you crazy? You know, we're about to go to college, you know, but he wanted.
This marriage that Jay mentioned, Margie told us that it was short-lived and Clint got a divorce. He was later in a long-term relationship with another woman, and the pair had two sons together. Here's Margie again.
He was married shortly after the Army, and then they got divorced, and then he came home. And that's when he met the mother of his two boys. I'm sure he knew this gal from before, from school. And they got together. They did not get married. I found out a little bit later that they had applied for a marriage license, but never went through with it. And he had two sons. I think, like with the first boy, he was just jumping up and down thrilled. He was so happy. I think it was a year later that he had his second son. And I think he was completely overwhelmed, was working at a local plant here in town. After 2.5 years, the two of them broke up. The relationship with the mother of his children, she has a humongous family, just lots and lots of relatives. As long as he was being a dad and a husband, they were quite nice to him. When he got overwhelmed, then everything went awful for him. So he was just extremely stressed with that. For 2.5 years, they were okay, but then they weren't. The stress has got to be too much.
After the breakup with the mother of his children, Clint met another woman named Robin, and the two lived together and seemed to be doing well.
Let's see. After the Army, the work that he did, he worked the Great Dane plant. It was called Pines at the time, and then they changed it to Great Dane, but he worked there. They build trailers, like, say, Walmart trailers and all these other kinds of things. And he had a really good reputation there. He is a hard worker and he made really good money. I think he was in some kind of supervisory position eventually. And that's where he met Robin. And they seemed to have a whole lot in common. They both liked motorcycles. They both liked trucks. They were staying in a house that her mom owned here in town. And Robin was decorated beautifully. She really had a talent for that. And they liked grilling out and invite us over for that. they seemed to be doing, you know, really well. We were told that they were married and she took his last name, but now we can't find any record of them ever being married. I don't know if they were ever married. And that's when the mother of his two boys said, we need some child support here. And that's when things got pretty ugly. So that whole thing played out in not a really good way.
We don't know the other side of this story about child support that Clint was paying. We only know what Clint had relayed to his mother about it. But it's an important part of the story because it illustrates why Clint may have wanted to leave the area, or perhaps why it was believable to his family when they got that letter that he wanted to start his life over.
Clint was ordered by the court to pay the mother $400 a month. He said he sent it out, and she would say she didn't get it. And she kind of kept doing this back and forth and back and forth. Finally, he got pulled into court again, and the judge reversed a decision that Clint would only owe $400 a month. He said, I'm going to reinstate that you owe $10,000 on top of the other, even though you were with them for 2.5 years. So that's also on top of this.
Clint was working as a truck driver and would see his family when he was bringing a load through the area. The last time they physically saw their son was at the end of 2002, just before Christmas.
He wanted to see us before Christmas. Christmas holidays were just extremely important to him. He loved gifts. He loved gift-wrapped gifts. That was like a big favorite of his. He's like a big kid. But Clint wanted to meet at a Peoria truck stop. And so we did. Clint's brother and his dad and me, we gave him a Christmas card with some money in it. And we sat and talked for a while. It just seemed really nice. I love that memory. At the time when we last saw him, he seemed quiet and stressed. He's never really been, you know, a loudmouth or anything, but he just seemed subdued. He's quite a bit like me. He does not hide his feelings well. You can see it in his face. You can see it in his eyes and his body language. And then he called for our anniversary on December 30th of that year to wish us happy anniversary.
The next call from Clint was an angry one, and it was over a misunderstanding about the child support.
The next year in 2003, when it was the last time anybody heard from him, he called home because he drove a rig. And in Illinois, they do the weigh stations, and when he went in, his load was off. So that what they do is they run their license. Well, someone from the mother of his kids, someone from her family, had taken out a $2,000 body attachment warrant on Clint for not paying child support. And they arrested him and took him to the county jail. And the company that he worked for bailed him out. He called home, and he really let us have it. I answered the phone, and he really let us have it. Said, you do this to me, and I get put in jail and everything. And we were just completely shocked because we had nothing to do with it. And after a little bit, I handed the phone over to his dad, and we were on the phone for like at least an hour. And he firmly came to believe it was not us, that it was not us that took out the body attachment warrant. He thought it was us that did that, and we did not. It was the relative of the mother of his kids. He ended up, everything was absolutely fine, according to my journal. You got to realize this, what, 19 years ago. Some of the stuff I wrote down in journals, but it was very brief. I didn't put down details that now I would see as important because I never in my wildest dreams believed I would never see him again. So those details aren't there. So I don't remember if he told us where he was or anything like that. I think he was just so upset. Like I said, after everything with the child support and the judge reversing his decision, they left that house and moved to a farmhouse in Wyoming, Illinois, and from there they were gone.
Margie thought everything had calmed down, and Clint was working to pay down his child support arrears. It wasn't odd to go periods of time without hearing from Clint. He was on the road a lot. Months later, Margie checked her mailbox and found a letter from Clint, and she was shocked when she read it.
And then in September, I get this letter and it's addressed in cursive on the outside, no return address, with a postage mark of Peoria. And it's addressed to Gary and me, but it mainly was telling me there were more F-bombs in that letter than I can count. It was typed. Clint wasn't prone to using that language that much. And so there were all these in there. And I read that, and it said that he had left Robin and he found a woman with a lot of money, and he was going to marry her and take her name. And I would never find, we would never find him. Don't look for him. That he had somebody else mail the letter, so that he said, because I know how you are, you like to investigate things and you're going to try to find me. So I'm not even where it was mailed. I'm somewhere else. You've always loved my kids more than you loved me. You loved my brother more than you loved me. You have Dad wrapped around your little finger. Don't ever try to find me. I'm never coming back. Signed, Clint. And I cried so hard I couldn't breathe. I gave my husband the letter. He read it. He started to crumple it. And I said, don't do that. And he gave it back to me. And I read it again. And I cried till I couldn't breathe. And then I put it back in its envelope.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. Margie was heartbroken that her son wanted nothing to do with his family. She carried that hurt with her for many years, thinking he just wanted to be estranged. But it always nagged at her. She thought something was off. Maybe he would call on a holiday or a birthday. But that call never came. Had he really run off with some rich woman and started his life over again? Was he really planning to run from child support forever? In 2018, Clint's father passed away, and Margie thought for sure this would be the event that would bring her son out of hiding. But that didn't happen. Margie explained that she finally decided it was time to report Clint missing.
His dad passed away in 2018, and over the years, I asked him, can't we just please just go ahead and call the FBI or call missing person or make a missing person? And he had this, he did not like law enforcement, and he was afraid that if we tried to list Clint as a missing person, that it would push him further away. He said, let's just wait for him to come home on his own. So it never did. So then that's like probably the first question they asked me when I tried to list him as a missing person. Why are you waiting until now? It's so hard to explain that to anybody. And he's an adult. And the first time I tried to do that after Gary was gone, I was told by law enforcement, you know, he's not technically missing. And then it just got to me so bad that I finally tried again, and I did get someone that would take the report.
Maybe the police were hesitant to take a report because it looked to them as some guy who had just fled to avoid paying child support, and no one had bothered to report him missing for so many years. Was this truly a missing person, or simply family estrangement? We have seen in other cases that sometimes people do walk away. In 2020, we covered the case of Benjamin Redfern, who had been missing for 3 years. His family was convinced that he would have never walked away and that he must be dead. To our surprise, after the episode aired, a listener of the podcast recognized Ben. He was their coworker. He had left the state and was living off the radar and didn't want to reunite with his family. Police confirmed his identity and closed his missing persons case. While that type of outcome is hurtful for those left unable to understand their loved ones' decisions, at least they know they're alive and no longer wondering about all of the what-ifs. Could this have been the case with Clint? Shortly after Margie was finally able to report her son missing, the investigator assigned to the case called her with surprising news. She believed that she had found Clint alive.
I think Rosa, she's no longer with the department, but she took it in 2020. And just, I'm telling you, within, I'm sure in my mind, I remember it as being within 48 hours, she said, "We found him." He had an order of protection filed against him in 2019. She was wrong. She had the wrong person. To a mother, do you know what that did to my insides? Thinking that he really is alive? He's alive. He's alive, you know, and I'm all excited and I'm happy and she's wrong. And she even sent me a picture. And I said, "What is that?" And she said, "That's your son." And I said, "No, it's not." And she said, "Yes, it is. That's your son." And I sent it to his Army buddies, family, friends. No one said that was him. And then she came back later and said, "My bad, that was the wrong person." I asked her, "Please call Social Security and ask them. I can't do it myself. I'm a civilian." And she said, "I don't think we can do that." So I called Social. I couldn't stand it anymore. And they said, "Oh, just have your detective fax us the information. We'll let her know." And she said, "I didn't even know you could do that." She said, "It shows there's been no activity on his Social Security number since 2003. So there's that.
In her efforts to find her son, Margie started a Facebook page hoping to reach Clint or someone he may have met after he sent his parents that letter, saying he didn't want to be a part of their lives anymore.
I don't remember the year I started a missing Clint Washburn Facebook page. But I did, and it's been many years, hoping that someone would, you know, see it and had seen him and would let me know, or he would see it and contact us. And nothing happened. And over the years, I would get discouraged and I would take it down for a little bit and then I'd put it back up. And this year in March, on the 8th, I went to take it down because I was discouraged again.
Margie was feeling discouraged again because she was getting nowhere, but this time she noticed a message to her page before she deactivated it. The message was from a man named Steve, who was the son of the woman named Robin that Clint was in a long-term relationship with around the time he mysteriously vanished.
There was a message from Steve, and that was Clint's stepson, and he had written to me a note in October of the year before. And he said, "We need to talk." He said, "I've got something I need to tell you." And I got a hold of him that night. And he told me that his younger brother had seen the page and said, "Look, she's still looking for him. We got to help her out. She can't go on like this. I didn't realize this."
Steve seemed like he had something on his chest weighing heavily on him. His approach seemed genuine, and he was willing to tell Margie what he knew. Steve explained to Margie that his brother had seen Clint in Kentucky in 2003, but the whole thing was very bizarre.
We talked, and he said that his brother Carl had seen Clint in 2003 in Somerset, Kentucky. He came home, and he saw Clint was pale and bloated and incoherent, and his mom was rushing him out the door saying, "Clint's going to go to Texas." And that was the last he ever saw of Clint, and that was in Somerset.
Had Clint gone to Texas? Could that be where he married some rich woman and started over? Steve had yet another story to tell Margie about what he was told about Clint's fate.
Stephen was called in 2009 by his aunt, which would be the wife's sister, and she said, "Your mom just confessed to me last night that she killed Clint in 2003. She was just hysterical, absolutely hysterical. And he said over the years, he's called his mom and asked if she did, and she denies it. But no one has seen or heard from him. The Social Security, the IRS, nobody has heard from him since 2003. There have been two private detectives, one that called me, and I don't know who he was hired by, but it was probably 5 years after Clint. We just had no contact. And he said, do you realize your son has fallen off the face of the earth? And I said, no, I didn't. I just kind of thought he was off on his own. And then Stephen and his brother hired a private detective, and they couldn't find him. The other one, I don't know who he was even hired by. I suspected him something funny because he said, Clint has, we think he's a witness to an accident, so we're trying to get a hold of him.
Hearing this from Margie, we knew we needed to speak to Steve ourselves. Could this story be true? Steve certainly seemed invested. He had gone as far as to hire a private investigator to try to find Clint, because he was so disturbed by the possibility that what his aunt had told him could be true. So we caught up with Steve, who was able to fill in some gaps for us about this time frame when Clint went missing, and the relationship that Clint had with Steve's mother, Robin.
Well, I don't know when they actually got married. It's very weird. Yeah, that would have been, my junior year in high school, so like 90, I want to say close to junior year in high school, probably, so like 98. He was another guy, she, in a long list of guys that she would date, and we never really, at that point in my life, I really kind of gave up on doing too much of getting to know her new significant other at the time, because she had a pretty good pattern of meeting guys, dating them for a while, and then really just kind of draining them of everything that she could, money-wise and possession-wise, and then she'd move on to somebody else. So, but from what I remember, I mean, he was a nice guy. He was never mean to like me or my two brothers, wasn't abusive. If anything, he actually stopped her and I from getting into it a few times. But I know he was in the Army at one point. He was somewhat in shape. He had like a little boxing gym set up in our garage. And I mean, he seemed to be a pretty nice guy. I didn't really know much about his past. You know, as far as my interactions with him, they were always good. In the last part of time that I knew him, drove a semi. It was a little bit different than some of her other relationships. It seemed like her other relationships, she drank a lot, alcoholic, and she used to date the same. And a lot of those guys were pretty abusive. There's a lot of physical violence growing up and all that. With Clint, it seemed different. It seemed like it kind of switched. Like she was kind of definitely the dominant one in the relationship. He seemed a little more passive, but I mean, they got into like some arguments, of course, and there was some yelling, but like, I never saw him like physically assault her or anything like that. As far as I knew, that was somewhat of a stable-ish relationship and for her standard. Yeah, he drank, but not as much as she did. Like I said, a lot of times he would kind of be the calming voice if she was starting to get a little out of hand, so to speak. It was one of the few relationships she had where there weren't physical fights like in the house and stuff going on like that.
When we first heard Clint's story, it seemed to jump from Illinois to Kentucky without much explanation. In fact, if you look Clint up online, he is listed as missing from Peoria, Illinois on March 15th, 2003, not Kentucky. And that's because that is the last date and place of contact that law enforcement was able to confirm. While speaking to Steve, he explained to us what he was told about why Robin and Clint left Illinois and how they ended up in Kentucky.
2002, I believe, I had gotten out of the military and I moved back home, and her and him had moved out of the town we were living into a house out in the country, in a farmhouse. And he was gone a lot, still driving a truck. And I moved in, was living there. I was working, and kind of out of nowhere, all of a sudden, mom says that her and Clint are moving to Georgia or running to Georgia. And, I kind of pressed her on why or what was going on. And she said they had to run. They were basically running from the law, so to speak, because Clint owed like $10,000 in child support. So they were going to run to Georgia and take off. And it was really weird because it was a super like, one day the moving truck was there, loaded up a bunch of stuff in the moving truck, left a bunch of stuff. I chose not to go to Georgia And I ended up moving in with my aunt in her house. And they took off and went to Georgia. And from there, it got even weirder. I don't know. They were living out of hotels from what I can gather. I mean, it's hard to believe anything my mom tells me. So I tried to figure out what really happened out there. She had said that he made a phone call back to Illinois when they were in Georgia. So that forced them to have to leave Georgia. And then from there, they settled in Somerset, Kentucky. So they ended up in Somerset, Kentucky. And that's kind of where the disappearance goes from, I guess.
Steve told us that while they were living in Kentucky, that his brother went there to visit, and it was all very strange.
Would have been 2003. My other brother, that's just a couple of years younger than me, was in college at the time and needed a place to stay for one of his breaks in college. My aunt wouldn't let him stay with her. She said she didn't have the room. So he ended up going down to Kentucky and actually seeing them there at the house. And he said it got really weird. Like, what, he got there and Clint was not the same Clint that he used to be. And he was a little more overweight. He was pale, kind of looked bloated maybe. And he said that he's not sure what was going on with Clint, but something wasn't right with him the night that he got there. He said he was either like high or drunk or possibly poisoned. But mom, I guess, in the kind of later in the night, you know, kind of ushers Clint out to the car and tells my brother that she needs to take him to his truck because he's leaving for, he has to go to Texas. And so she takes him out to the car and leaves. And as far as we know, that's the last time anybody kind of has seen him. That's kind of where the trail kind of ended. I didn't really think much about it. You know, she told me he took his truck and went to Texas. So at the time, I didn't really have any reason to doubt that. I want to say that's probably would have been around spring break time. That might have been when my brother was down there.
Steve and his brother never saw or heard from Clint again. But as he mentioned, they had no real reason to suspect that anything was amiss. Their mother had been in and out of many relationships over the years, and most of them were tumultuous and didn't last long. But years passed, and then Steve got a call from his aunt, the one that Margie mentioned earlier, and things took a sinister twist.
Fast forward to like 2009, I get a phone call from my aunt, and that turns out that the day before they were out on the river in Illinois, out on the Illinois River on the boat, and that's where mom confessed to my aunt that she had killed Clint. So my aunt calls me, crying, kind of hysterical, telling me that mom killed Clint, burned his body, and disposed of it on some property that she owned in Kentucky. So, you know, my aunt and I have this short conversation about this. So I immediately call my mom when I get off the phone with my aunt. You know, I asked her straight out. I was like, hey, what happened to Clint? Did you kill him? Like, what happened? Did you kill this guy? And her reaction wasn't normally what I would have thought would be. If you ask somebody if they killed somebody, she was somewhat calm about it. Didn't really seem shocked. Denied it, of course. Told me that she didn't know where he was, that he had disappeared and gone down to Texas. I pressed her on it a little bit, kind of let it go. I don't know. Probably should have done more then, I guess. But I started looking online searches for Clint throughout the years, trying to find him. I'd find names that would pop up in like El Paso, Texas for Clint. And, you know, I guess I just wanted to think like, oh, that's gotta be him. You know, there's no way she killed him. That's gotta be him. I've hired private investigators a couple times over the years and none of those have ever panned out. They've given me names and addresses and phone numbers. And I called all those and wrote a couple letters and I've never heard anything back. Maybe one of them was Clint. He just didn't want to talk. I don't know. And I only found out recently, allegedly, what had happened. So Rhonda originally just told me that she killed him, burned his body, and then disposed of it on some property she owned in Kentucky. And that was back in 2009 in the original call. In the subsequent phone calls I've had with her in the last couple of weeks, you know, then she tells me some details that Robin was worried that about Dallas, my youngest brother's safety, and to keep him safe, she had to kill Clint. I asked Rhonda, well, how does killing Clint protect Dallas? She didn't have an answer. She didn't know. But that was the reason, evidently, of why. I don't think that's the reason why. But Rhonda tells me that Robin told her that she lured Clint into a shed or a barn with the promise of some kind of sexual thing, and then tied him up and beat him to death.
Steve openly admits that both his mom and his aunt can be unreliable, but having this information always nagged at him. Could it be true? He spent his own money and free time trying to find Clint to clear his conscience of this information, hoping it was all just a story. Maybe the whole thing was made up. It was those searches that led Steve to Margie.
I came across Margie's blog about him still being missing, and I was like, I gotta talk to her and tell her. And that's kind of what started this whole part of it. So, yeah, I called her, and I talked to two detectives from the Kewaunee Police Department. I've tried calling the FBI agent involved twice and left messages. I haven't heard back from him yet. It was frustrating to try to get to the point where, like, just getting somebody to look at it. It's hard for me because I don't know. I mean, you see my mom, Robin's criminal record, and she, I don't know or can trust anything that she ever says. Just searching her, it comes up with so many different, she just changes her birthday or adds an L to their name. Her MO would be to get a job as like sales or service departments of car dealerships. And then she would embezzle money or steal plates and titles and different things like that. She got caught from Sud's, I think it was a Porsche dealership in Tazewell County. She got caught with that one. You know, I've just always been so amazed at how she's not spent so much time in jail.
After Steve connected with Margie and the two compared notes, he learned of the letter that Clint's parents had received in September of 2003. Steve told us his thoughts on the letter.
From talking to Margie, I know they got a phone call from Clint in March 2003, and that was the last time they spoke to him. And then they got that weird anonymous letter that was typed with no return address in September of 2003. That's definitely something I think didn't come from Clint. In the letter, he said he met a rich woman that was going to take care of him. He was going to change his identity and disappear. And basically, I hate my whole family. You guys are all terrible. I never want to see you again. Don't try to contact me. And I'm going to go live in Texas under a new name with this random rich woman. You know, hearing that, I'm like, there's no way Clint wrote that. And I asked Margie, like, was that normal for Clint to write you letters, or would he just email you? Or, you know, he was good with computers. We had one at the house. Remember him using it a lot. Would he have just emailed you or called you to tell you this? Or would he have written a weird anonymous letter with no return address that was typed? So, you know, there's the letter, and then it's just a lot of stuff here that I don't know who to believe and which part of it's true and what parts of it are true. It's been a little roller coaster. Clint had a semi, and he did just disappear. Well, what happened to the semi? Where's the truck? Somebody would notice a semi that was abandoned.
Margie's conversation with Steve about the letter made her rethink the assumption she made in 2003 when she received it, and wondered if that letter could be a big clue for law enforcement.
It wasn't until almost 20 years later that Steven said, she doesn't do anything without a plan. And her plan was to get you to stop looking for him because he was already gone. And so what better way to do it than to send you a letter? He said, is that how Clint communicated with you? Did he do that kind of thing? I said, no, he either come to your face or he would call on the phone. He wanted direct contact. And he said, so he said it was typed instead of handwritten. And she has so many things on her record for forgery and that sort of thing that as far as signing his name or addressing the envelope, the letter was typed, and the only thing that was written was Clint and then our names on the outside of the envelope. Something that traumatic does tend to stick in my mind, and seeing that letter typed that way just was odd. Just like I took their word that they were married, I took the word that this was from Clint. But it came out of left field. It just was so sudden and so out of character. It was in the letter. It said, I know you're going to look at the postmark, but I had somebody else mail it. When the officer was here at the house, I told him, I'm disabled and I can't get up the stairs and I can't stand for any length of time at all. And that letter is in Clint's old bedroom somewhere. He went upstairs and he looked and he said, I can have some officers over here and we'll search and we'll find that letter. He said, what we want to look for is to not find Clint's prints on that letter. He backpedaled and decided not to do it at all.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs. And then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. When Margie first reported Clint missing, she didn't really know where to start. She had known that he was living in the Peoria area with Robin, but she didn't know about Kentucky until much later, after Steve contacted her. So Margie had reported Clint missing to her local law enforcement, the Kewaunee Police Department, and they still hold the case today. But you can imagine that learning about Clint moving to Kentucky and these stories of an alleged murder has complicated their ability to work the case.
As I understood it, if he was killed in Somerset, then that's over state lines, and so it was okay to call the FBI. And they never hung up on me, but there's a special agent's name in Clint's report, and I keep leaving messages, or kept leaving messages for him. Not ever one time, not once ever did he return a call. And the chief of police here in town has never returned a call, not once. The head of detectives came over and told me they were dropping the case. So that's where that is. We're no longer going to investigate. He stood here in my kitchen with his arms crossed and said three reasons. He said, we only did this as a courtesy to you as a resident. He said, it's outside of our jurisdiction. We have too few resources and we have more important pending cases. I get stopped by the dispatcher and I get my email bounced back from the officers. So it's getting impossible to get through. It's just been a nightmare here. And I can't get through to them. They don't want to hear about this anymore. They're done. Like I said, I was a reporter for 13 years in the courthouse, and I got to be friends with all these people. But my vision is failing, and when he walked in that day and stood by the kitchen sink, leaned up against it with his arms crossed, I said, I'm sorry, I can't see you very well. What's your name? He said, Mike. And I went, oh, Mike. And he just went off. And I was to not contact them anymore. And if I had something new, maybe that would they'd put it in the file, but they were done.
Margie tried reaching out to authorities in Somerset to see if they would investigate, but she seems to have hit a dead end.
Well, when I called Somerset, I get flipped from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so I was told since he was killed in Somerset that I need to contact them. So I contacted them and she said, well, your son's listed as missing. And I said, he is? She said, yeah, you did it. She said, it's in every computer across the nation. Every time his name comes up, it's going to show him as missing. I was really pleased about that. But that was early on. And of course, stuff kind of went downhill from there.
You're probably wondering if the home in Somerset where Robin's son says he last saw Clint has ever been searched. Margie told us about the difficulties she's faced trying to track this place down.
Their home in Somerset, I never knew what the address was. So no one's been able to search it. I've been in contact, not very often at all, with the local authorities there, county, state, and local. And Robin has so many aliases that they can't find anything at all in their names, either name or any of the aliases that I gave. But they absolutely assured me, and I thought that it took way too short of a time for them to have accomplished this. They can't find their names anywhere at all in Somerset. Nowhere. No rental. They said that, but they also said nothing in any kind of utility. I have no clue as to how far they went or what questions they asked or which databases they used. My husband's niece did some kind of a search. She found one of the aliases that Robin uses and an address in a nearby town. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was a massively huge place with a pond and acreage and outbuilding and all that. Oh, goodness, more than $1 million home. And that name was on it as where they lived. But when I talked to the Somerset authorities and gave them that address, they said, could you tell me whether Clint and Robin could have afforded a place to live in a place like that? And I said, I don't know. I don't know what they did for a living. And I don't know if, because their conclusion was that she was just using the name of the person that actually lived there as one of her aliases, that wasn't really her. She was just using it as an alias, and that person actually owned that place. Because as soon as I saw it, and having been told by Robin's sister what was in her confession, I could see where she could have done this that she's accused of and hidden him. So as far as anybody searching anything, I don't believe law enforcement is even going to make an attempt to search that property. They have no proof that she ever lived there or that they ever lived there. They don't have any proof they lived anywhere.
Margie continues on with her search for Clint. She has spoken to Steve's aunt, the one who claimed that Robin made some sort of alleged confession to her. True or not, the story still horrifies Margie.
Late at night, she will message me on Facebook and she'll tell me things. And it was that he was getting ready to leave his wife and her son. He did not have children with her, and she didn't want him to go. So she lured him into a barn-like structure and beat him to death and burned his body. The words are coming out of my mouth, but I can't allow my mind to wrap around that or give it much thought, because I think it would shatter me worse than I am now. I still have giant sobbing, wailing things just from finding my husband dead across the room from me back in 2018. So to think about Clint going through that at 29 years old, I can't make my mind do that. Stephen told me that he was told that Clint was poisoned. And then the more I find out about the woman's background, I find out that she's had this history of abusing her boyfriends, her husband. She has a bazillion aliases. I've given as many as I have to law enforcement. Actually, I found her myself. The law enforcement said they couldn't find her.
After hearing these stories, Margie thought back to the times that she had met Robin and what she knew about the relationship between her and Clint.
My first impression of Robin, oh golly, how do I put this? She's very pretty. I could tell she was older, and come to find out she's 11 years older than Clint. So he would be 49 today, and she's just turned 60. She seemed kind of direct. The mother of his children, Tracy, she's really laid back and quiet, just like the total opposite. I was kind of surprised that Clint was drawn to someone who seemed so tough. We met Robin many times at her house. They were grilling out, and we got to see how their house was. You know, it's kind of strange, though. There was always seemed to be a tension, some kind of a tension thing going on, but we kept everything light. The last memorable time with Robin was on Mother's Day, 2002, I think. We met at a park, and they had a nice truck and an even nicer grill. And Clint was cooking the meat. He bought me a lighthouse, a little wooden lighthouse. And her parents were there. It was the first time we met her parents. Everything seemed okay. Clint called us later and said, asked if we had fun. And we said, yeah. He said, so everything seemed okay? And I said, yeah, it seemed okay. He said, well, I guess we pulled it off then, because all of that was fake. The pleasantness of the whole thing. He said, we're just not happy. He said that her parents were pretending to get along, and that he and Robin were pretending to get along and just keeping everything very pleasant. And after we left, they went back to their anger issues and just like they normally felt. So apparently the whole thing was an act so as not to spoil Mother's Day for me. I had no clue. I thought I was more perceptive than that. Like I said, there were times I felt tension. I've got this picture that I have of Clint and Robin at our house at a Christmas party that we had. But really, we didn't see a lot of her.
Margie has also tracked Robin down on social media and spoken to her as well. But she hasn't gotten much in the way of answers from her.
Her messaging conversation with me could have been that letter, because she was saying some of the same things that was in that letter, which now that I think about it makes me more than ever convinced that she's the one that wrote it. But I mean, I'm not saying I'm 100% correct, but after 20 years that she would remember what he said to me is kind of strange. And that messaging frenzy that went on Sunday night, I just specifically asked her directly, were you ever married to my son? And she said, I think he told you all he was going to tell you about that. That's it. There was no yes or no. I don't know what the point after 20 years, why not just tell me? But I've checked with our county courthouse, and there's no record of them getting married or divorced. So if they were, it was in some other place.
We were able to view a message exchange between Margie and Robin. Robin said the following, I've never hidden myself. There is nothing to hide from. I most certainly didn't harm anyone now or ever. What I did do that I knew not to do was move back because Clint always said this would happen. In a subsequent message, she said the following, you are doing what he said you would do. And if he wanted to contact you, he would do that. He's a grown man that has a right to do what he wants with his life, even if you don't like that. The issues you and he have are a big factor for him, among other things. If I stayed gone as I was supposed to, no one would find me unless I wanted them to. I am aware of Rhonda's story. She came to me with it before you, though it sounds like the story has changed. A name being dead is not the same as a person being dead. Margie responded to Robin and said, IRS and Social Security have no activity on Clint since 2003. Clint would have not missed his dad's death, or that of his favorite aunt, grandpa, and grandma. He had a grandchild in August. His oldest son looks just like him. A national podcast will air next month. I'm praying that if Clint is alive, he will reach out to someone. You haven't provided any proof that he is alive. Also, Carl gave a pretty graphic description of the last time he saw my son. For reference, Carl is Steve's brother, one of Robin's other children. Then Robin went on to say, I'm aware that Carl was on break, and that was the last time he saw him. Clint went back on the road, and Carl went back to school. You can't live in two worlds at the same time, not if you do it correctly. You don't know what he would do or wouldn't do. I think you've forgotten some of the issues that were there. I don't need to prove anything. We made a decision. He has followed through, and I made the mistake of not following through. I keep my end of the decision. I am aware there is no record. There would not be one of me either. If he reaches out after the podcast, then that's his decision. Margie went on to bring up Robin's lengthy criminal record, and Robin responded by pointing out that none of her crimes were violent in nature. The way that Robin speaks in these messages, she seems to be alluding to the fact that she believes that Clint is alive and well and has changed his identity. It's unclear if she's claiming to have contact with him since his disappearance or not. At one point, she said, "I don't control him and neither do you. He doesn't trust me because I returned. In hindsight, I never should have. What you've learned isn't what you want to hear." It remains unclear to us if Robin was ever interviewed by law enforcement, but we would be interested in hearing her side of the story, if she hears this episode and wants to reach out. Robin's son Steve told us what he thinks happened to Clint, and that there was something that he witnessed with his own eyes that makes him believe that his mother is potentially capable of harm.
I think she did something to Clint. That's just my gut feeling. With going back of the years growing up with her and knowing her that intimately, I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility for her to kill somebody, basically. When I was like 12 or 13, I watched her trying to put a bunch of sleeping pills in her, at the time, husband's water. I came downstairs to get a glass of water and saw the capsules on the counter, and she was mixing up the pills in the water. And I just told her, like, you can't do that, and she didn't. Knowing that, what I honestly think happened, I think Clint either wanted to leave and was going to ruin and expose what she was doing, or she no longer had a use for him and she felt like he was maybe going to get her caught. And I think she did something to him. There's so much shadiness involved with everything that she's ever done in her entire life that it's hard to say which route it went, but I lean towards that she did something to him. And the luring him into a shed and, you know, beating him to death doesn't sound like her MO, but him being not of the right mind, I guess, to put it, when my brother saw him that time, and knowing that she attempted or would have poisoned one of her previous husbands, and that was a volatile relationship. They were in physical fights all the time in that relationship. So not justifying what she was going to do, but that's where that was coming from. Like, he was super physically abusive to her. She was abusive to him. It went both ways. He never touched us. He was somewhat of a nice guy in that respect, but those two together were just terrible. And, you know, knowing that she could do that, or even would get to the point where she is mixing the drugs in the water, it's not a far leap for me to think that she would take it further. I don't see her beating him to death with something in a shed, but I could see her poisoning him and doing it a different way. She used to be a power lifter, and like, she was big into like the gym, and she was in really good shape in her younger years. But I mean, more recently, she's had back surgery. She's no longer physically able. I don't remember how physically active she was back in 2002-03 timeframe. And that's the thing, is I don't know where this would have taken place, because I talked to my brother and I was under the assumption that the place they were living at in Somerset, Kentucky, was out in the country. It wasn't. It was in town, and there was no shed or barn on that property. So she would have had to have gone to a secondary location if that was the case.
The idea that Clint could have walked away from his life still lingers, and Steve hopes that is the case, because that is a much better outcome to believe in.
I had told Margie, I was like, is there a possibility Clint really did cut you guys off? And I was like, I know that's a hard truth to face too. Neither option is very good, but is that a possibility? And she says no, but I know his brother was saying that there was some animosity there in the family, in their family, and Clint thought that his family took the side of his ex-wife and the kids and the child support hearing, from what I gather, or with the kids, something with the kids. Not saying Clint did just disappear, but, you know, ideally, I hope he's living his best life on a beach somewhere in Mexico and doing his thing, but I just don't.
One aspect of the story that we didn't want to overlook was that Clint has two sons who were very young when he disappeared, and they grew up believing that he had just abandoned them. This was traumatizing for his children. But then hearing the latest stories has forced them to rethink everything they thought they knew about their father.
The kids now, I really don't like to say this. They've been told all this time, and we know this from multiple sources, that Clint ran out on them. and didn't want anything to do with him. And so they grew up just, they couldn't stand him. When they were told that a woman confessed to killing him, they both immediately lost it. They just lost it. And his oldest son, who looks just like him, has been trying really, really hard to find his dad. He really believed at first that Clint's alive, and he's done deep searches as far as he can go. You know, just saying, I know he's alive. I know he's alive. And he's come around to thinking that he's not. And so now he's building a shadow box for his dad and collecting things for him and just calls him his dad now. He barely could call him by his name. The youngest son has been in trouble with the law for a long, long time, and he's been in prison 3 times. And he's currently in our county jail. And he completely lost it when he was told by a detective that Clint is presumed dead. So I think the guilt came crashing down on him, and he lost it.
Clint's friend Jay told us that he didn't realize that his friend was missing until many years later, when he tried to find him on social media so they could reconnect and catch up. His heart sank when he found one of Margie's posts, and today he has a lot of regrets.
I saw a post on Facebook, looking him up, like trying to look up old friends. Well, you know, Clint, I was like, man, you know, I wonder what's going on with his life, you know, with how to get Clint Washburn. And then literally, like I'm the Facebook investigator, looked up every Washburn and everybody that was related and just trying to piece together stuff. Then I saw that, yeah, he's missing. I'm like, what? Then I reached out. So I don't know if this is the right person. And I think I got his aunt that got me in touch with the mom. Like I said, I just feel like a shitty friend because, man, if his life went like that downhill, I just wish I could have been there to help him. I mean, completely blindsided and just like, oh my God, this is a good friend. We were best friends. You know, I would have pictured him when I was looking for him. I was kind of expecting to see him and like with kids and a family, not missing. And it kind of shocked me that his life went the way that it did. Because I just seemed like he had it together. It was going to be another one that's normal. Get out of the military and you're going to settle down and have kids and go to work every day, 9 to 5 and go home. My question is, if he was hiding something, some bank records or something to show something, I mean, he would need money. I mean, how do you work or get a bank account? That's what blows my mind, is there's nothing.
So what happened to Clint Washburn after he disappeared sometime in 2003? Did he really walk away from his life as the letter his parents received suggested? Did he marry a wealthy woman and changed his identity, leaving no trace of his real identity in nearly 20 years? Or is this story from Robin's sister really true, that Clint was killed in Kentucky? Or could something else have happened? Could Clint have left and taken his own life somewhere along the way? There's clearly not enough evidence to prove any one theory, because it took nearly 2 decades for any investigation to begin. And even that has stalled out for now. For Margie, she hopes that her son is out there and will come forward and let her know that he is okay. Or maybe someone else who knew Clint over the years will make contact. She just wants to know what happened to her son. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Clint Washburn, you're urged to call the Kewaunee Police Department at 309-853-1911.
The letter could have just not ever been mailed. And he could have just disappeared off the face of the earth. We never heard from him again because he's not here. And the letter wasn't necessary. Why would it be necessary? I mean, really, other than fear of, hey, you know what? We haven't heard from him for a while. Let's start looking into that. So it's a thing to use to call you off of any search you might do. Hurts your feelings really bad, and you don't dare try to look for him because he doesn't want you to find him. So you just don't look for him. If you don't look for him, then many years pass, and then now it's 20 years later, and where is he? How am I supposed to look now? How do I even begin? How much time the time has passed, and what can you find? I don't even know how we're going to do this. I'm not going to count on anything. I've been knocked back so many times that now that's what I expect. So anything above that's going to be a treat. If I had my deepest wish, obviously, would be that he's alive. But if he's not, I want his remains home. And if she's kept any of his possessions, I would really love those. And I've begged for those. If anybody's got any of his possessions, mail them anonymously. I don't care.
That brings us to the end of episode 376. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review. You can also support the show by contributing on Patreon. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from Washington. Thanks for listening. Hey Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.